Tune in to a groundbreaking episode of the Get Lost Podcast. Get ready to be amazed as we sit down with a visionary travel expert who's revolutionizing family adventures using the power of artificial intelligence. Discover how AI becomes the compass guiding his family's globe-trotting decisions, unveiling hidden treasures, and crafting unforgettable experiences. From spontaneous detours to perfectly planned escapades, this interview will open your eyes to a new era of exploration. Join us as we explore the world with AI as our co-pilot, only on the Get Lost Podcast. Globe emoji, robot emoji, plane emoji. Artificial intelligence wrote this intro.
Shall we play a game?
Welcome back to the Get Lost Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sills, a freelance travel writer for outlets around the world. Today's guest is an entrepreneur, a chef, a real estate developer, and a world traveler who's made himself a human guinea pig for using artificial intelligence on the road. He's traveling the world right now with an AI travel assistant, and he's filming it all for his show, No Fixed Address. His name is Michael Modamedi. Michael, hello and welcome to the show.
Joe, thank you so much. That was quite the introduction. I hope I can live up to that for your audience.
I'm sure you do. Michael's a great follow if you guys are on TikTok. You've got 300 and something thousand followers, which is pretty cool. But you can catch him running around the streets of Paris and Morocco and stuff. And I think what I would best describe as a Steve Zissou cap. Did you do that intentionally? Yeah, you got it right there. I, too, travel with a red beanie everywhere for Wes Anderson-related purposes.
I'm a big Wes Anderson fan, but I think predominantly it's for bad hair days. I mean, I think, you know, yeah. I've contemplated shaving my head quite a bit. It's just really nice to just throw a cap on and walk out of the house.
Yeah, yeah, I feel that for sure. I may have a lot of hair, but sometimes you just got to throw a hat on. Talk to me a little bit before we get started in the use of AI and travel. You're doing a thing called Anthony Bourdain, Bourdain, and AI is capitalized. So your take on travel and even your TikToks and short form videos are all about what would Anthony Bourdain do. Why did you pick Tony to zero in on? Was he your inspiration for all this?
So Anthony Bourdain is one, but the most person that I concentrate on when it comes to kind of vicariously living through somebody else's eyes using AI. But we've used Picasso, we've used Dolly, mm-hmm. we've used other individuals as well too. But to answer your question in short, I mean, Bourdain is and was a hero of mine. He inspires me every single day and I miss him every single day, even though I never even knew him.
Yeah.
There's a void. That's the perfect terminology to use. And, you know, when I travel, even prior to using AI, I always had his lenses on, right? Mm-hmm. It was really about getting to know the culture and getting to know the people. It wasn't about getting that perfect Instagram shot. Like, even if you go to my TikToks or my social channels, very raw. I mean, there's nothing glamorous about it, but it's the truth. You know, and one of my missions in life is to really allow individuals, specifically because my audience is predominantly in the U.S., mm-hmm. to see the beauty in all of the countries that I visit. Mm-hmm. And this fear mongering and this kind of propaganda that comes from being scared of different countries or cities or people in my opinion, is a bunch of BS. We're so much more similar than we are different.
Totally. Yeah, I agree with that. And I'm from a part of the States that is like really xenophobic at times. Not Memphis as a city, but the area around that, where I spent a lot of time growing up, people are afraid of their own shadow. And they're, you know, they're afraid of France. They're afraid of Japan. They're afraid of anything, especially China. Like, they're just freaked out by anything that doesn't come prepackaged with an SEC football jersey on, you know? So it's really weird. What part of the States did you grow up in?
I grew up in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
I was born and raised in LA, but at the age of 17, ended up going out to Europe for a good stint, and then ended up going to university in Canada, ended up staying in Canada, became a dual citizen, then ended up moving to Kentucky. So right by Memphis for about 5 or 6 years.
Right on. Where in Kentucky?
In Louisville.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Very familiar. Those are super analogous cities, by the way. They're historic rivals in college athletics, but they're very, very similar demographically, topographically. They're just almost twins, almost.
Louisville felt like a blue island in a red state, you know, almost like a Chicago, Illinois type thing. It was very liberal, you know, very welcoming, very warm. But as soon as you kind of stepped out, it was like, who's this dude in a beard walking around?
Totally. Yeah. People would be freaked out. Memphis is the same way, and Nashville to a large extent, even though there's like a very conservative group on top of the state capitol that they kind of like lord their power over the rest of the state and make everyone's life miserable. But it is like that, like a blue island is, and a lot of the cities in the South are this way. Not to digress too much, but former guest Rebecca Holland wrote a story about ethical travel in the U.S. and is it ethical to travel in the South? So she tagged me in because I think travel writers in general, largely based in L.A. or New York or maybe the Bay Area, but like there's not a lot in between. So she tags me in and asks, is it ethical to visit the South when we have all these problems going on with human rights? And I said, yes and no. I think the cities are great. I think, you know, the broad picture painted by politicians is not what is really reflective of most of the people on the ground there. You know, it's not 1862. Most of us don't want gun laws that enable everyone to have a weapon or no human rights for women and things like that. Like it's insane that that's even a conversation, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm a big advocate of people are people. I don't really judge people on where they're from or their political standing. If you're a good person and I can hang out with you and you're nice to me, I'm nice to you, you know?
Facts. Yeah, facts. So Michael, back to topic. The reason I wanted to have you on the show is because you've got a PR firm and they help you out with some stuff, distributing content and things. And they sent me an email that made me jump out of my chair. Like, I got this email and I was like, what the fuck is going on? Because the title is just Anthony Bourdain, AI, capital. It says, hi, Joe. An AI tool like GuideGeek doesn't just provide travel suggestions tailored to the user's needs and preferences. It can also help you see a place through the eyes of a famous person. Travel influencer Michael Motamedi explains in a video where he asked GuideGeek to show him what Anthony Bourdain would do in Barcelona. And at this point, I didn't even read the rest. I just fired back with like... He would hate this. Like, I feel like Tony would hate this. I feel like he would hate AI. I think he would hate most of the things I write because they're listicles and they just exist to pay a bill. Can you explain how AI is helping you find places and making travel a little bit more colorful for you?
Yeah. And first of all, you're not the first person to say that. A lot of comments emulate your thoughts.
Yeah.
As well as my own, by the way. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm not sitting here preaching, telling the world Anthony Bourdain would love AI. I've never once said that.
Yeah. Right? And to be clear, we don't know. I just think he was really irreverent and would hate it because it smells like corporate America.
Yeah. And that's kind of where my thought process comes from, too. And if you watch my videos specifically on Bourdain, they're always end with a question or some sort of conflict, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of like, hey, It doesn't really matter if he would hate it or if he wouldn't. Or do you think that he would hate it? Do you think he would approve? I kind of place it in the audience's hands to better understand, like, what is the temperature out there, right? But from my perspective, what it's doing, specifically when it comes to kind of vicariously living through an individual, let's use Bourdain for the sake of this conversation.
Right.
It's bringing me closer to him, you know, in a really weird way. I mean, I'm not friends with any of his friends. I never even knew the man, right? And so when I go in and I give a prompt and I say, hey, I'm in Barcelona, pretend I'm Anthony Bourdain, what do I do, right? Now, whether the AI is right or wrong, it is scraping the internet with all of the public information that we have of this man, this great man, right? And creating a very, very finite, laser-focused answer for me, right?
Right.
And inevitably, I'll follow it. And what happens is I end up meeting some of the coolest people and going to some of the greatest places, right? And there are going to be critics. And they're going to be like, well, that's a tourist area, or that's a this, or that's that. And I'm like, that's fine. You know, I'm going to a market in the middle of Barcelona called La Boqueria, and I'm eating Iberico ham and buying olives and meeting the olives lady and meeting the ham lady, you know, and really enjoying life to the fullest. And I think to piggyback off of this kind of maybe hatred or fear of AI, to me, if you know me, and hopefully your audience will get to know me a little bit better after this show, I am all about human connection. Okay. I don't even play video games. I don't know how to play video games. Okay. I'm hardly on the computer. I'm out there. You know what I mean? And I'm meeting people, and people are like, man, you get along with every single person you walk into. And I'm like, the number one thing I do is just smile before I say anything. You know what I mean? And so this idea of allowing technology to make us more distant is not my motive. What I'm trying to do with AI, specifically in the travel realm, is how do we utilize technology to bring us closer together?
This is an interesting take to me. It's not really where I thought it would go, and I like that. Can you explain to people who don't know anything about AI, how does this work? I mean, you mentioned a prompt. I'm familiar with ChatGPT, which I think is the most well-known AI tool at the moment. But can you just break it down and explain how this actually works?
Yeah, absolutely. So the beautiful thing about GuideGeek, it is tailored to travel, basically, right? And that's number one. Number two, it utilizes WhatsApp and Instagram DM. So you don't have to have an app or go on a website or open up Safari. It's like you're chatting with your friend. And number three, it's free, which is fantastic, right? And the way that it works is you literally, at least the way that I utilize it, is that I just have a conversation with it. I'm like, hey, what's up, guy geek? How you doing today? I'm, you know, in Barcelona right now, and I'm looking for a really great pizza to have. I'm in the Born district, and, you know, I'm looking for something a little bit different.
Right.
Boom. Answer comes.
So you talk to it the way you would talk to another person on the other side of the DM, like it's a chat bot, but much smarter than a chat bot.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think that's a good way to describe it. I mean, I describe it a little bit more esoterically in the sense that, like, it's like my best friend, or like a, not my best friend, but like a friend that I have living in a different country, you know, like, and I want to ask him a question, like where to do and where to go and what to do. Sometimes my friend is wrong. And a lot of times he or she is right.
Everyone knows what they say about fish stories, but this one is true. A while back, I was mountain biking along the Arkansas River near a place called the Big Dam Bridge. In the distance, I could see the afternoon sun falling over Little Rock's lone round peak. Beside me, I saw a tranquil, rippling pool next to an old railroad bridge, secluded from the rapid river's flow. It was exactly the kind of spot that I'd bike there for. So I hopped off the bike, reached into a backpack, and pulled out a fishing rod. Then I spent the rest of the afternoon watching time slowly roll by in the warm afternoon sun. I even caught a few fish right there in that spot, with my bike laying on the ground and the shallow sand beneath my feet. This is the kind of fishing story that doesn't have a big catch or a record bass attached to it. It's just a peaceful afternoon by the water, the kind that helps you unwind from all of the problems in life. If you listen to this podcast, chances are you've got a nose for adventure yourself. And if that nose leads you to the water, I suggest picking up a tool that can help you enjoy more moments like these. When I travel, I often pack a fishing rod, and though many portable options abound, I like the rods from Wisconsin's St. Croix rods the best. St. Croix's Avid Trek and Triumph travel rods break down into a case that fits in a backpack, or an overhead bin, or behind just about any car seat. They're designed in the USA and made with care from a family-run company that knows some fishing stories don't require any exaggeration. Sometimes, just being on the water is enough. You can learn more about St. Croix's travel rods at stcroixrods.com, and you can tell them the Get Lost podcast sent you. Now, back to the show. This is a question I wanted to ask you based on my own experience with AI. So, a couple months ago, and all this will be outdated in 6 weeks, but a couple months ago, I was experimenting with ChatGPT, which is an AI-powered tool that writes papers and things for you. It can write papers for you. This is the same software that's getting school kids in trouble because they're not writing their exams and things like that. You know, it's making people submit high school essays in Google Docs so that professors and teachers can see the history that you actually wrote it, theoretically. So I was using ChatGPT to try to write some content, some travel writing content, because it's supposed to take a lot of the busy work off your plate, right? So I can ask ChatGPT, okay, ChatGPT, I'm in Barcelona. Tell me the best markets to go get Iberico ham. I'm in Orlando. Tell me the best hacks to get insider access at Magic Kingdom. And it actually will populate like really well-written paragraphs that you could publish at a lot of places and no one would be the wiser. But once I started digging a little deeper and fact-checking this, I realized that it wasn't actually all true. Some of it would be true, and then some of it would be information that sounded true, but it wasn't. So University Professor Sid Dobrin is a specialist in AI, and I talked to Sid a little bit this summer. Sid gave the analogy that he asked an AI paint tool to draw a picture for him, and he said, draw a salmon in a river in Alaska. And it drew this beautiful mountain stream in Alaska, and you can see the water rippling over the rocks, and you can see glacier in the distance and snow and clouds and peaks. And then you see a salmon in the river, but it's a salmon like you would put on a dinner plate. It's like a cooked piece of salmon, you know? That was 6 months ago, and he said AI was technically accurate. Yes, there is salmon in a river, but it's not... It's the nuance.
I don't know why it's making me laugh so hard.
It's so funny. He had the picture of it. It's literally like cooked pieces of salmon in the river as if it was like swimming. That was 6 months ago. Now, if he asked it to draw the same thing, it actually gets it right. So my question to you is, have you had an instance in travel where AI was like almost right, but you could tell that something was kind of wrong?
Oh my God. Yes. 100%. It is not perfect right now. And to me, at least because of the position that I'm in, you use the word guinea pig. I think that's kind of a really great way of putting it. Mm-hmm. For me, it's exciting, right? I'm here to learn the ins and outs, right? And I'm here to improve it. And those are the conversations that I have with the Guide Geek guys all the time, where it's like, hey, this happened. This happened. Fix this. Mm-hmm. Make it learn. Right. And this was conversations that we had with Guy Geek from day one. We're like, is it okay to be transparent about these mistakes? And it's absolutely okay. Like the idea that technology is perfect on day one is, to me, is ridiculous, right? But I think as humans, what we like to do is poke holes in everything that we possibly can and say, I'm right, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And so I don't come from that mind space. I come from the mind space that like, it's going to make mistakes and it's going to be okay. One of the examples that I like to give a lot is, you know, in the infancy of Google Maps, we used to hear these horror stories of people, you know, driving into lakes or rivers because Google Maps would say, make a left, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, put your common sense hat on, you know, it's not perfect. There has to be a little bit of a human intervention in this as well. And that's another cool thing about GuideGeek, and because it comes from a travel perspective, is that there are real-time individuals working on this that are ensuring that the data is as good as it possibly can. There are also real-time flight data being inputted as well. And in the next couple of months, there's actually going to be real-time hotel data being placed in here as well, too. So it's becoming this all-around thing that's not 100% perfect. But to give you an example that you asked, I, again, am not an AI expert. I'm a travel expert. So I don't know how it derives this false information, but I can give you a little example that happened the other day. So I'm actually posting the video today, and it's the three, you know, most infamous or most the famous French cocktails that have ever forever existed. Right?
Okay. All right.
And where can I find them?
So you asked it that. The prompt is, where can I find the three most famous French cocktails?
Did it in two prompts. What are the three most, you know, French cocktails? Where can I find these cocktails? Mm-hmm. Right. And 95% of the answers were absolutely fantastic. And I inevitably ended up having the most amazing time ever, going to the coolest bars that I've never even heard of, became friends with everybody. But at the second bar where it was recommending a cocktail, which was the Corpse Reviver number 2, I believe it was, right?
And I
go to the guy, and I'm like, hey, you know, the AI recommended me to have this French cocktail. I said, that's not French. That comes from the bar in London called Savoy. And I was like, whoa, I mean, I wouldn't have known, right?
Yeah.
And so me and my wife, who's on these trips with me, obviously, all the time, we started doing some thinking. Anyways, he ended up giving me an awesome French cocktail regardless, right? But we started thinking, I was like, oh, maybe AI thought it was from the region of Savoy. And it was pulling information of Bar Savoy. I mean, again, I don't know, but I just thought it was interesting.
It's hard to know. I'm not an AI expert either. We really need Sid on. He would know about this. He's an Adobe thought leader that goes around and talks about AI and explains it to dumb people like me and you.
You know, exactly.
I feel like in my mind, AI is terrifying. As a creative, as a writer, I feel like there's a narrative that AI is going to take your job. And my experience with ChatGPT was that this thing can't take my job. It was actually more work to let ChatGPT write part of a story for me, and then I have to go back and edit it, than it would be just to write the story. But it grows so fast and it learns so quickly that I think in the next few months, like it makes these light speed leaps, and it eventually will overtake people. And then allegedly, we're going to have like prompt engineers that will take over the job. And a prompt engineer could write 50 listicles in the time that I could write 2. And
yeah, you know, when it comes to jobs and technology, unfortunately for me, technology is this huge, massive liner that's just moving. Right.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that's going to stop it, because legislatives and lobbyists and Elon Musk's and whoever of the world, you know, are creating for what the future is going to look like. And I think we can use same examples in the industrial era, or, you know, when different sort of manufacturing tools were coming out and were wiping out individuals who were working in the manufacturing lines. I mean, it's sad but harsh truths that technology does lessen the use of human beings, right?
Yeah.
But I have this weird kind of optimistic, maybe hopeless romantic idea that humans bring something special to the world that a computer or AI cannot. And we will always find a place here, right? Now, whether that's a prompt engineer or whatever it may be, at some point, and again, I'd love to talk to the AI expert that you were referencing, but where is the AI getting their information? Obviously, people are going, experiencing, and uploading this information to the internet so that the AI can then go and contabulate it and write that article that you're speaking about, right? I mean, there's not robots walking around India, you know, having street food.
No, but that would be cool.
Exactly. I think people would freak. Now, that would people would freak out.
I freak out when there's a robot cleaning the airport floor. Like, that weirds me out. I was on a golf course the other day. I don't even play golf, but I was covering a golf resort for an article, and there was a robot golf bag Swear to God.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. It was a golf bag.
Like for a caddy, a robot caddy.
Yeah, it was the craziest thing. And I'm like, that's actually like super smart. Like, I like that. So some robots I like they are robots. Some robots I like, some robots freak me out. And then whenever I have like a negative thought about a robot, I think about that scene in Star Wars where like C-3PO and R2-D2 walk into Mos Eisley Cantina and the guy's like, yeah. Hey, we don't like your kind here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh shit, am I like an asshole? Am I like robot racist? Like, what? Should I be nicer to them? Because like there was one in a convention I was at the other day, and it to me looked like a snitch robot. It was like a security droid, you know. It came up to me. I had a skateboard because that was how I got around the convention center, and it came up to me and it just like stopped right in front of me and was. I felt like it was looking at me weird. It looked like a big egg. It was like a ghetto version of R2-D2.
It's fun. I don't know where I saw this or what interview it was. I don't know even if it was Musk, but because I know he's always been like a big, hey, raise the flag on AI or what it can possibly do.
Yeah.
But somebody was like in a debate with him or someone, and I can't remember, so please forgive me, but he's like calling him a humanist. And he's like, yeah. The guy was like, of course I'm a humanist. Like, as in, like, you know, that thing you were talking about where you were like, the robot walks in and you take the human side.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, I think that's okay, you know, but there are going to be some extreme political left people that are going to raise their hand and say, you know, we want some equal opportunity for.
I mean, there's an argument to be made on is AI sentient? And if AI is sentient, then is it a living being and does it have rights? I heard an episode of Astonishing Legends, which is one of our favorite podcasts, a while back. This was years ago on AI. And this was before ChatGPT really broke. And, you know, everyone was like, AI is the distant future. And then suddenly now it's upon us. But they speculated that it is possible, it's conceivable that AI is sentient or some versions of AI are sentient. And who the fuck knows what's going on in the government labs, you know? We don't know what's happening in Area 51 with AI. We don't know. So, yeah, maybe there's an argument for that down the road. But I want to talk to you more about your travel experience. So you're in Paris right now. You're in the middle of this AI journey. How long are you going to be on the road letting AI take the lead? Or is this now like a permanent way for you?
Well, right now, the experiment's going to be going on probably for a full year, I would say. Mm-hmm. We started about 3 months ago, and just to give everybody a little bit more context, we asked GuideGeek at the end of every single trip where we should go next, and we prompt it with certain things, but because we are an experiment ourselves, we keep it very open-ended. Mm-hmm. As in, hey, we like the beach, we like markets, we're really into food, or hey, we just came from a metropolitan city. We're moving towards, we're slowly making our way over east, you know, into deep Asia. So we also prompted with that too. Please make sure we're continuing going east, right?
So did you end up in Paris because it knows you like food? And it's like, okay, Paris, world great food city.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And then once we arrive, then we start utilizing AI with extreme experiments. Instead of just doing, hey, I really want to have some escargot. Where do I go? It's really about invoking Anthony Bourdain's spirit or Picasso. You know, it's really using AI in a way like the cocktail thing, right? What are the most three famous cocktails? Where can I find those three most famous cocktails, right? And I think the reason why we're using it in this way is because we believe that that's where it's going to go. Personally, for me, I think it's a great tool to utilize in a way where you can ask for the top bests or best of or whatever it may be you're prompted for. But there's also Google for that, right? I mean, I think there's an argument to say that, hey, the WhatsApp inside of your phone, and you grab it and you ask a very poignant question and you get a very poignant answer back is a really strong argument. Don't get me wrong. But that's not what we're here to do. We're here to do something almost revolutionary, right? This AI is planning our lives and where we live for the next 12 months. And so experimenting with prompts and what we can and not and cannot ask and what it makes mistakes on and what it doesn't make mistakes on, to me, is my responsibility, right?
I see. And yeah, you are assuming some risk too, because it's not just you out there. You've got your wife with you. You've got a small child with you. So your family is on the road and you guys are putting your well-being on the line. Are you fact-checking too when it gives recommendations? Will you then say, okay, I'm going to Google these three cocktail bars, or are you just rolling with it?
You know what? It's kind of hit or miss. Sometimes we'll do a fact check just because we want to ensure, because of the responsibility that we have to the AI, right?
Yeah.
To ensure that we're giving the right information back. But a lot of times we just roll. I can give you a funny story. We were in Marrakesh, and in every country that we visit, I get a haircut. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's just like a ritual thing that I do. Everyone loves it because I end up looking like a beast at the end of the month. And, you know, and then this whole big transformation happens.
So, you can't see Michael because of the show, but he's got like a really luscious beard, great hair. I mean, you look like you would be a perfect platform for a barber to come and like do their thing, you know?
Exactly. I'm an open canvas, you know? Mm-hmm. But so I asked Guide Geek, I'm like, hey, we're in Marrakesh. And if you've ever been to Marrakesh, we were staying in the Medina and it is chaos. Okay, like imagine the largest, most intricate, most alleyway bazaar you've ever seen in your life. Now you're living inside of it. You cannot walk without 75 top people talking to you. Smells, colors, vibrancy. There's a lot happening, right? And so I asked AI, you know, where's the best barber in the Medina? And it gave me this answer and we started going. And guess what? Google Maps didn't know where it was. And so we got the exact address. We went to Google Maps and we started looking at where we were in the Medina. Cause you know, these Medina alleyways, Google Maps is not, you know, good in these alleyways.
It's tight knit. It's like really, really close corners and probably no street addresses.
Yeah, exactly. And so we ended up finding, we feel like we're in the right place. And I'm asking the gentleman who's like begging me to come into his restaurant, hey, do you know of a barber around here? And as I said that, this other gentleman walked by and said, barber? And he raised his hand. And I said, yeah, I'm looking for this barber. And he goes, yeah, barber, yeah, haircut. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, come with me. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. And so he takes me down another couple alleyways, me and my wife, again, to your point about safety, right? Yeah. And at this point, I'm looking back to my wife, like, is everything cool? Are you cool? She's giving me the thumbs up. You know, hey, it's all good. She's probably more experimental than I am. But, and so we end up on this small little door in this small little alleyway that knocks on the door open. This other little man comes out of this very small door. And they talk in Arabic for a while. I end up walking into this gentleman's home, sitting in his living room, getting a haircut. There's no sinks. There's no shampoo. There's no nothing. There's just a guy with scissors, and I'm sitting in his living room, and I'm getting a haircut.
Now, what in the world?
There's a video on this, too.
So it's just like a guy. Like, was he actually a barber or just a guy that you had to cut hair?
He was actually a barber who does a lot of the haircuts for local people around there is what we found. Now, do I truly believe that AI knew about this guy? I really don't know. Okay. But did AI take me to this one specific area and I ended up in this awesome guy's house and I had one of the best haircuts of my life? Yes. And that was freaking cool.
It feels like it could go on either way. And if it does know about this man, like this unknown man in an unknown place in a dungeon in Marrakesh, like that's terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. So both have negative sides to it, I think.
It does make you wonder how much data is being shared. You know, we all have location sharing on our phones, watches, whatever, air tags. Where does that data go?
Yeah, it's true. I have no idea.
Does Tim Cook know where everyone is in the world? And is there like a big Dr. Evil map of the world, like War Games in the Apple headquarters, and they can see?
I will tell you this. I don't know, but I've come to a place in my life that I don't care either.
I have also accepted that, you know, our shit's just out there.
Yeah.
It's just out there. And I think,
millennials specifically, you know, we probably fucked up. Like, we probably fucked up. We put way too much of our images and likenesses and likes and dislikes, and we were feeding the machine for like 15 years because it was fun. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I can never be private again. Like, everything is just out there.
But I mean, not to diverge the conversation too much, I do think that at some point our pre-internet era or our pre-internet life does control a little bit of our hesitancy to share, because there's the next generation. What I see on TikTok, I'm just like, oh my God, you get fired from your job, you're out, you're doxing your boss. Like, you people are filming themselves quitting. They're like walking out of the office or breaking up with your boyfriend or breaking up with your girlfriend or whatever it may be on video, and then telling everybody the dirty secrets of this individual. Or what about the random individual who has a breakdown? I mean, I saw a video the other day. Random girl has a break, not the woman in the plane, but there was like a random girl at the bar of the airport. She was having a breakdown. She was having a bad day. Okay. Yeah. Seemed like a pretty normal individual. Probably just had a really fucked up day. Okay. Yeah, probably 12 hours of flying. And there's a dude at the corner of the bar filming her, you know?
Wow. I haven't seen this. That's crazy. Yeah. That's not surprising. You know, that's crazy. Yeah. Maybe you're right. I mean, I do clearly remember. I mean, I don't know. I was in college when Facebook broke, right? And then, like, yeah, we had MySpace before then, and like that was sort of the beginning, and AIM before that. But yeah, there was a whole world I remember before the internet was like at our fingertips. And yeah, you could log on and like get on some like slow, you know, ponderous version of a computer that got you to AOL and your email and whatever. But it's different now. And it's true that people not that much younger than I am, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 35, not that much younger than me, they don't remember a world without any of this.
Oh my God.
Instagram itself is old enough that people that were born while it existed can now drive.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. And to me, you know, it's still a thing that I remember happening while I was behind a computer desk in South Memphis. And I remember very vividly downloading this app and scrolling through it and seeing images of Big Sur and like Montana national parks. And I couldn't fathom what I was looking at. I couldn't fathom that you could just get in a car and go and see these places. Like, I didn't know who these mysterious people in the woods with cameras were.
But you bring up that point that I was bringing up earlier, which is using technology to make the world a smaller place than a larger place. You know, it's like, bring us closer together. Like, right now we're in the middle of that with AI. We're going to have the same conversation over some drinks in like 20 years from now and be like, hey, remember life pre-AI? And it's like, yeah, I do. And everything was okay before and everything was okay after. I just want to keep reiterating the fact that, like, go out there, see the freaking world, man. You know, like, it's just, it's bizarre to me that the amount of people that just in fear, they don't really want to get out of that, you know? Yeah. And there was this Mark Twain quote, I can't remember exactly how it went, but basically was saying, like, you know, to get rid of bigotry, to get rid of racism, to get rid of narrow-mindedness, right? You can't do it in the narrow corner of the world that you're in.
No.
The cure to all of that is to get out and meet people from different parts of the world and to envelop and embed yourself into these different cultures, because yes, they're much, much different than who we are and what you may be, but they're also so similar to you. They want to have a warm meal at the end of the day. They want to crack some jokes and they want to live their lives just the same way that you do. They might look a little different, smell a little different, eat a little different, you know, dress a little different, whatever it may be. But I promise you, if you get out there, you give a hug to a stranger, you have some cracks, you make some laughs. I mean, dude, it goes a long way to open your eyes up.
Have you had an experience other than the one in Morocco where this played out in real life, where you maybe were intimidated at first by an individual and turned it out like they were super awesome?
I mean, for me personally, I guess maybe because I travel so much, I'm not really intimidated by really anybody, you know, like, and I understand that there are different, the biggest thing to me is I guess there's two big things when traveling for me. One, an utmost respect for every single person. You're in their home. It's not the other way around, man. Okay. Yeah. So you're going to their home, just like as if you were to walk into your friend's house, like just use that same mentality and have the same amount of respect. They don't owe you anything. You owe them something. You're there.
Yeah, you're on
and
their turf.
I think that you're on their turf. And so that's number one. And then number two is just like lead with an open heart, you know, and understand that there are different temperaments. It's culture, right? Like the temperament in the South is different than in L.A.
Yes.
The temperament in L.A. is different than it is in New York.
Yes.
And so the same thing happens like when you're in an Arabic country, let's say Morocco, where the temper, maybe not the temperament, but the way of communication is a little bit more aggressive, right? I mean, I made some videos or I was on live and some people were like, why are they fighting with you? And I'm like, they're not fighting with me. That's just how they talk. Wow. You know, the dude is just excited to sell me his kebab because he's so proud of it. You know, I was at a street vendor.
Yeah.
He's like,
yeah.
He's just super proud of it. And there's 25 other kebab stands around me and he wants me to go to his place and eat his food. And that's how he kind of emulates his emotions. I mean, the same thing happens in France, too. It's a very, very extremely civilized, quote-unquote, first-world type country. Mm. Everyone says the stereotype of France and in French is that they're a little bit rough or around the edges or maybe even borderline rude. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, I don't know. I don't really see it that way. I see it like this is just the temperament of the city that we're in. I don't sit down in a restaurant and the waiter or waitress or the server treats me differently than they would in New York or in LA, and I'm in Paris and I'm thinking this person hates me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, okay, this is just how they are.
It's a good point you bring up. And like France does have that stigma. The last time I was in France, not long ago, a few months ago, like the second day I was there, I found myself in a castle at a dinner table with candelabras next to like viscounts and stuff at a dinner party. And that's not like the circle I normally run in, you know, but it just happened to be like my college roommate lived there. He's French. We went to see him and he's like, hey, I'm having a party at my castle because of course I have a castle. And, you know, there we were. So we helped make the food, my partner and I, and we helped serve dinner. And then we sat down and burned the candle down until well into the night, you know, but it's that stigma you can break by just being open-minded. And that night was so interesting because there really were only two or three people there that spoke fluent English, and our French is really, really bad, like most Americans. But we had a great time because we made it work and we had so many laughs and a great meal, and it was just fantastic. Michael, while we wind down, I want to talk to you a little bit also about traveling with your family. Your wife, Vanessa, she was a producer at Discovery Channel. She's probably seen a lot of the world too. What's her take on the AI recommendations?
Well, she honestly is doing a lot of the prompt engineering, to be honest. Mm-hmm. With her background, and she actually, you know, cut her teeth as a researcher prior to being a producer at Discovery Channel. Mm-hmm. So her brain is very analytical, right? Mm-hmm. Like she's the type of person that if you ask her a question and she gives you an answer, you better believe she's been through every Reddit thread, every single article, and a couple books. It's just who she is, right?
Solid travel partner.
Yeah, exactly. I'm more like, hey, what's up? Let's go get a cocktail, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the way that she describes it, I think, is super interesting to me. And she's super, super humble about it, so I don't want to come off audacious in any way. But she almost describes this as a kind of a mission that we're on, right? Mm-hmm. We are literally doing something that's somewhat revolutionary in a sense. She always likes to say it's not like we're going around the world in 7 days, but we are probably the first family who's, you know, given control to AI to travel the world. And there is a sense of responsibility on our hands to not only be transparent and authentic, but also really, really use it. And mm-hmm. and we use it, and she uses it. And the answers that we get, we actually go and do those things. And I think that's the sense of responsibility that she has on her shoulders. A lot of people are like, well, are you actually doing this? And I'm like, it's really happening. Like, this is the truth. But it's interesting. I mean, with a 2-year-old in tow, you have some travel restrictions, obviously. That's why we stay everywhere we go for 1 month at a time. Mm. It kind of goes first Penelope, but then secondarily allows us to really understand the culture in a real, real authentic way.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't think we could get out of 4 or 5 days.
Right? I would agree with you on this. I think slow travel is the way to do it. And if you can stay 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, it's really tough for a lot of Americans because we don't get enough time off. But if you can make that work, then that's so the way to experience a place. I agree with that.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate because of the amount of time that as Americans we have off, or I mean, people in general, to be very honest with you, not just Americans, right? I think it, this idea of let me try to see as many things as I possibly can in the shortest period of time. To me, it's more about quality over quantity. And the more people that I see, it's quantity over quality. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, to be honest with you, they're bitching. They bitch. Oh, the lineups. Oh, the stairs. Oh, the flights. And it's yeah. like, yeah, if you're trying to jam in 75 things in like 4.5 days, guess what? Those flight of stairs get annoying. But you know what? If you're in the Amalfi Coast for a couple weeks, and you know what? If you don't want to go up and down those stairs one day, you don't have to. It's a different type of life. You know?
Yeah, it's a more normal approach to things, I think. But I don't know how normal places like Amalfi Coast or Paris, or I mean, I don't know. I don't live in a place anymore that's like heavily touristed, but it is interesting to think about the difference between people that are out there trying to have like the local experience while you're traveling versus like the actual local experience where everyone that's not from there is throwing it off, right? Or are they just part of it?
Yeah. The locals themselves, or are you talking about the tourists?
From a local point of view, so when I was living in Memphis, or I guess I still kind of do, but when I was in Memphis more often, you know, it was part of the scene that you would see European tourists come through and they wanted to see Elvis and all that. A lot of Asian tourists as well would come through. And I don't remember at the time having a viewpoint of like, oh, these tourists are ruining everything. They were just kind of blended into the scene. But I wonder how that works in a place like Morocco or a place like Paris or Thailand, you know?
I mean, personally, I think it's just part of it. You know, when you're coming to these extremely touristy areas, and I also think that like at some point you don't really even notice it, right? I mean, you go to New York.
Yeah.
I bet you 50% of those people are tourists.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Everyone walking around Manhattan, for sure.
Everyone walking around Manhattan, I bet all of them are tourists. You go to Times Square, I mean, what sort of local do you know hangs out in Times Square, right?
There's one or two, and they're selling things.
Yeah, exactly. But point is, like, I think if you kind of embrace the fact that this place is so beautiful that everybody wants to visit it, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I do every single day. People look at me and they say, man, you're living the life. You're so lucky. And, you know, I am. I'm not denying that. But do I wake up depressed some days? Of course. Do I have anxiety? Absolutely. And I think part of, to piggyback off what you were saying, the tourism that's involved in all these different places that we go actually makes me feel so special.
Yeah.
I'm like, how am I depressed waking up this morning? I got another 30 days here. There's someone here who's going to be here for 24 hours. You know, go have the best day of your life, Michael.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. But kind of wind down here. I want to talk to you once again about AI because you brought up a point earlier in the show I didn't think about. I think some of us imagine AI as a robot or as Data on Star Trek. Or at least as an app on your phone or a portal you can log into. But GuideGeek is just a DM. It's that easy. Do you think that's just how AI integrates into the world? Like, is it more behind the scenes than we think?
To me, I think that's the only way it's going to be extremely successful in everyday life for the everyday human, right? Mm-hmm. It's your buddy. It's your brother, you know? It's your tour guide. It's your doctor. It's your whatever, right? And to be able to just have a communication process or a communication strategy that AI can develop where humans can just pick up a phone and have a conversation through iMessage or WhatsApp or a telephone call or whatever it may be,
yeah,
is really going to make the difference, at least for me, right? And I think you just sparked something in my head. The same reasons why I really don't like virtual reality versus I can see the use for augmented reality, mm-hmm, is kind of the same argument that I'm using here, right? Mm-hmm. If somebody can give me some contact lenses and I can throw them in my eyes and I can walk around and see information about cool things around me and answer my text messages, I could see myself using that. Am I going to walk around with massive goggles on my head and not even be a part of the world that I'm in? No, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that take. Press release you guys sent over is from research from Matador Network that says right now 1/3 of travelers are likely to use AI to research just this year. 1/3. That's a big number because I bet last year it was like 0.02%.
Oh, I mean, I talked to the, again, like, just so your audience knows, I'm not an owner in GuideGeek. I have no ownership stake. I obviously do have conversations with them because of how, you know, extensive our experiment is. Mm-hmm. But they're seeing, I've been hearing some skyrocketing numbers. I mean, I think, Joe, the main thing that I think people are utilizing it for right now is that sometimes you just don't want to research.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Google, to me, and I think to a lot of people, is research. Yes, it's at your fingertips. You know, you want to search for the best sushi spot. You're going to go to Yelp. You're going to go to Google reviews. You're going to go right. You're going to read articles. You're going to do all those things, and you're going to pick your sushi spot. Right.
Yeah.
I think right now, for me specifically, how AI is extremely helpful is for things that I don't need to do a lot of research on, and I just want an answer. I just want to go do it. Right. The reason why I said the sushi example is because I'm a sushi buff. I grew up in the Valley. Okay. It's the number one sushi restaurants outside of Japan on Ventura Boulevard. Right. For
sure. Yeah.
I don't want GuideGeek to tell me the best sushi spot. I need to take 20 minutes and find out what the best sushi is in Paris. You know?
Yeah. 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 But you need that for a fast cocktail or a way to, the unique view of the Eiffel Tower, for instance, or how to get around the long lines at Sacré-Cœur or something like that.
Or how does Anthony Bourdain see the world, right? Those are the experiments that we're doing. So I think the first half of what you said is true, and I think that's the easy way and the way that people are using it right now. What we're trying to do is be on the forefront of what people are going to be utilizing it in the future, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is interesting.
Like, I want to see what Bill Clinton does in Paris.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was just thinking, like, what else could we plug in? You could plug in literally anything. Bourdain is the example. And I still come away thinking he would be horrified. But, you know, a lot of things horrified Tony. So I guess it's okay. But, like, how would Julius Caesar experience Paris, you know? Like, you could do all of these different things and get probably some silly responses, but maybe some that really do open your eyes, which is the whole point of travel, right?
Well, in Barcelona, for example, we literally asked where Picasso would grab a drink, mm-hmm, where Dolly would grab a drink. Mm-hmm. We went to that bar. I sat in his seat. I had a glass of absinthe that he would have. I ordered his meal. I mean, it was mind-blowing, man.
That's pretty cool. Do you think that was information that you would have been able to find easily on Google, or was it something that would have taken a while?
I think that it would have taken a little bit more in depth. I think it wouldn't have been a conversational thing like we spoke about, like on WhatsApp, where I'm sitting at the bar and I'm literally asking GuideGeek, hey, what would Picasso order when he was at this bar?
Yeah.
Right. And I don't have to go on Google and pull out my, like, I'm just like literally on WhatsApp. Hey, I'm at the bar. I'm sitting here right now. What would he order? Oh, absinthe. Okay. Bartender. Is it true that Picasso, this is what happened. Is it true that Picasso would order absinthe sitting right here? Yes, he would. Brings over a bottle of absinthe, right?
There you go.
It's a little bit of a different experience than Googling it.
Yeah, it is sort of a different deal. I think it's interesting. Going into this, I wasn't really sure where I sat on AI and travel. Obviously, it's pretty intimidating for a travel writer, and I'm having to make my own adjustments in the career to deal with it. But the way that this works, where you just DM GuideGeek, I could see myself asking those questions. I could see myself actually utilizing it. And that's sort of terrifying for me to even say, but I think I probably will give it a shot. So, Michael, tell people how they can follow along with your trip, because I know you're in Paris now, but you've got some months left and you don't really know where you're going to go.
Yeah, so basically TikTok and Instagram, it's just Michael Motamedi. That's MichaelMotamedi on both channels. And yeah, we have no idea. We started this journey in Marrakesh. Then we ended up in Barcelona. Now we're in Paris, and we don't know where we're going to end up next. We are going to make a destination announcement after we ask GuideGeek at the end of the month where we're going to end up next. Hopefully it's a beach somewhere, but we don't know.
You have to prompt it for a beach. You might end up in Norway, though, so who knows?
Well, I think I've outstayed my European visa, so I'm getting close to it at least.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, you better get out of there. Michael, thanks so much for coming on the show and breaking down travel and AI in its infancy. I'm sure we'll have a totally different conversation in a couple years about it.
Thanks so much, Joe. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
The Get Lost Podcast is a production of Sold Outside Exploration Company. Make sure to give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. And hit us up on Instagram at Get Lost Podcast.